Okay, yeah, hi, how are you? Everybody, thank you so much for joining. Now, this is not a Tehillim saying class. I hope you realize you want to learn about Tehillim. So my idea was that today would be an introduction to saying Tehillim in general, and then each week I would pick a parrot. I'll start in the beginning, but after the first two or three, I would skip around to those that are most commonly said, like the Shir HaMalifes, the Howl Cousin in Davening, the ones like Chav, Lamed, Kuf Lamed, a Kuf Mem Gimel that are said much more often than all the other ones. And I'm very much open to any feedback. Anybody want to suggest anything, I'd be delighted. And please don't be shy. I'm not sensitive. And I don't take attendance, so anybody wants to come, doesn't want to come, you know, I want it to be easy for everybody. Hopefully this will be, it is being recorded as we talk, I hope. And we should be able to play it back. I hope that eventually I'll get better at it and be more able to tell people how to do things. Right now, I don't know very much. But okay, so I wanted to start talking about saying Tehillim. Now, Tehillim is written, actually it's written by a lot of people, but if you ask somebody who wrote Tehillim, most people say David HaMelech. Well, officially, there are 10 people who wrote all the 150 Pesukim from Tehillim were composed by 10 different people. But the vast majority was composed by David HaMelech. And we're gonna call it, the Tehillim of David HaMelech. Now, the thing with the Tehillim is that it has special kohos. It's not just like saying any tefillah. It has way more kohos than any other tefillah. And I want to pursue the reasons why. So first of all, we have to look into David HaMelech himself. David HaMelech, at the end of his days, at the end of his life, at the end of Shmuel days, when it describes how he's dying, it says, "The Eva Divrei David HaChaverim." These are the words of David, the last words. Ne'um David, this is the speech of David. Then you say, the son of Yishai, "Ne'um HaGever Hu Kam Ol." And the words of the man who rose up above most others, Mashiach HaLokei Yaakov, he's the one who Hashem himself anointed over Yaakov. Hashem anointed him. It was Hashem of Yaakov personally anointed him. Okay, and the image of Yisrael. He is called the pleasant singer of songs from Yisrael. Now, there's lots of reasons why David HaMelech was given the title of the image of Yisrael. And it really wasn't because he had the best voice, or because he wrote the most beautiful words of poetry or whatever in the world. No, David HaMelech's greatness, if you want to know about it, we have to start back when the day that Adam was created. When Hashem created Adam, at some point Hashem showed him maybe it wasn't the day, but early on in his life, Hashem showed him all the different people that would be born and would die. And he saw there's this one neshama labeled, David ben Yishai. He'd be born, he'd die within 3 hours. And Adam said, no, we can't do that. He called him a Yif-Yus. He said, Yif-Yus, this beautiful, handsome, not handsome, this beautiful neshama, sharing with 3 hours, he said, Malchus is Nido Halalu Nisuno. So I am going to give him royalty and Nidos, music. The Matana as a gift of 70 years. I bequeath to him the gift of 70 years of life with Dmivos and with royalty thrown in. Why? That he should live and he should say Dmivos before Hashem. Now, what was it about David HaMelech that Adam Harisham said, oh, this Neshama has to live. This Neshama has to say Dmivos. This Neshama has to be a Melech. I see it in him. And the answer is that he called him a Yif-Yus, a beautiful person. He didn't mean he had a beautiful nose or a beautiful jaw or a very handsome physique or anything like that. He meant that he had beautiful eyes. And we say the David Yifei Einayim. David had beautiful eyes. It's mentioned a few places in Tanakh that David's eyes are beautiful. Now, I don't think the Torah bothers to tell us if somebody had physically beautiful eyes. If Aaron Kutler had gorgeous eyes. But I bet you if you read a biography about him, it probably wouldn't list it as the main thing about him. My father all the time had beautiful eyes, but we don't usually mention it when we talk about him. So why are we bothering to mention David HaMelech's beautiful eyes? And the reason is because if somebody is in the Torah called beautiful eyes, it means that he sees things beautifully. He sees things straight. He puts things in perspective. And his attitude, when he looks at something and he translates it, is much more straight than your average person. So when David HaMelech saw that, when Adam HaRishon saw that David HaMelech had beautiful eyes, whatever he experienced, he looked at, and he translated and interpreted and internalized it in a beautiful way. He said, this is what Klal Yisrael needs. They need somebody to write beautiful songs of Shiva, so when they go through hardship, they see the beauty in it, and that's the harshness of it. And therefore, he said, he must give him at least 70 years of his life, so he could compose beautiful songs of Miros, and he could be a melech, and instill this beautiful tool and this beautiful way of looking at the world amongst us, that we should get used to it, and we should want to be like David HaMelech. You know, David HaMelech was a musician. He did have a harp, and he did, they say, left it by his patio door and let the wind blow, and when it blew and it started playing in the middle of the night, it woke him up and he'd get up and learn. And I don't know how they knew about it, but apparently this inspired the people of Yerushalayim tremendously. They said, I came to learn in the middle of the night, we're going to do so also. So it wasn't that he had gorgeous eyes or was handsome. It was that he looked at the world in a beautiful way and knew how to take the beauty he saw and translate it into Avodas Hashem of the highest degree. So we're going to come back to this whole idea in a little while about looking at things beautifully. But since this is, as a script I'm doing for my mother, my mother, if you don't mind, I'll take your indulgence and speak a little bit about my mother. And the reason why I started this class is because my mother passed away about 6 weeks ago, and I'm a big cry baby, so you'll have to forgive me. But if I cry, I'm trying not to. But I asked my husband, so what can I do? I should be as close to my mother. You know, everybody always feels like everyone's such a good daughter, they do the best. What can I do to do something for my mother's sake? My mother was very hard for me. She was very hard to raise me properly, to smooth out my rough edges, to make me somebody that, you know, eventually would want to be married to. She looked into each of her children and said, what did they need? What did they need to work on to succeed in life? And then she worked with them on it. So I would like very much to can't pay her back, but to do something for her. So my husband said, look, your mother loves saying to Hillel, why don't you give a class on Hillel? And I thought it was a great idea. But and people know that about my mother. It's very famous. He said tons and tons to Hillel. Just as a brief example, whenever any of her children or grandchildren went on a date, that was her evening activity. She said the whole sefer to Hillel. It would take her about 2 hours to say the whole sefer once. If she had two grandchildren on a date on the same night, she said it twice. 1 week, she said it five times. Well, twice on Sunday, twice on Wednesday, and once on Monday or Tuesday, because three of her grandchildren had 5 dates between the three of them. But I want to really talk about more what made my mother into the person she was. How did it come out that she was such a big Tehillim Seher? It didn't just drop from the sky. It's not just because she went to Chicago parochial school or whatever, but it really was more a product of the fact that she came from the parents she came to, because they said tons of film all the time. My grandfather, you know, when I was a kid, my mother and whenever it was my grandparents, they put us to sleep with stories. They would come and they caressed us and we would call it cracked us. You know, they caressed us on our arm or our shoulder or our back, and they would tell us stories and put us to sleep. And invariably, we love the stories about my grandfather the best. If I could just ask whoever's talking to mute their phone, it would be helpful.
Can everyone mute their phones, please?
Anyway, so my grandfather, he was born like in 1898 or something like that. And toward the end of World War I, he was drafted into the Polish army. And this is like the most famous of all the stories he told us. But many of the stories have to do with Tehillim. So I want to tell you one or two of them, and you'll get a little idea of how my mother became such a big Tehillim sayer. So he was drafted into the army, and he went. But while he was there, they had the great Spanish influenza epidemic, right, of 1918, 1919. And at some point during the epidemic, his father died and his brother died within a short time, a few days of each other. One of his sisters died, and he wanted to go home. You know, it was an Eish Tzara. He wanted to help his mother. He wanted to sit Shiva. So he asked for permission, but they wouldn't give him any. Now, my grandfather didn't like taking no for an answer. So he escaped. You know, he what do they call it? He ran away from the army. I forgot the word, but whatever. He a senior moment.
Drafted.
But he, No, that's the Timothy army. He ran away. He was, what do you call somebody who runs away from the army?
A deserter.
Thank you.
He deserted.
He ran away. Fine. He went home. And we were very happy he came home. But there was a guy in the community who noticed him and figured out that he ran away without permission. And he reported him. So he was duly arrested and stood before the army tribunal. And he was... The punishment for deserters in Poland at that time was a death penalty, and he was sentenced to death. But Baruch Hashem, they only hung 50 people a day, and he was number 51. So they put him in a cell, like the way he described the cell, like it was so narrow he couldn't even sit down. He just stood up the whole night with his hands through the bars. So what does a person do when he's in jail and he thinks he's going to die? I mean, a Jew, what is he? Obviously, he's davening. So we started saying Tehillim. And, you know, and as a child, I said to my mother, Mommy, how did he know it's very hard? So she'd say, well, because he didn't fight with his little brother and sisters all the time. Anyway, Lamaisa, he probably didn't know it by heart then. But even if he didn't know it all, he certainly knew many Plakim. You know, life in Poland in those days was very tenuous. And people lived with a Tehillim in their hand because every single day could be fraught with danger. You know, different stories they told us highlighted the danger of just walking down the street and walking past a guy or encountering somebody who would look at him funny and he likes to be a danger. Anyway, so he started saying to him and eventually fell asleep. And while he was sleeping, his father, who had just passed away, he came to in a dream and he said to him, he said, don't worry, tomorrow, and he said, your tefillos are answered and everything will be okay. Tomorrow you will be saved. He said, but I just want you to know that I have to put my own haba up as a security, as a mashkon for you. If you don't stay true to the Torah and mitzvah, I lose my own haba. So I'm warning you, if I lose it, I'm going to come after you. And then he left. And then he woke up, and he realized it was all a dream. And, you know, he wasn't sure, like, is this a real dream? Did he dream it up because he's so anxious he wants to be saved? Well, he didn't know, but you could rest assured he spent the rest of the night davening and, you know, saying to him. And shortly after sunrise in the morning, a tall, very handsome army officer, a captain or something, I don't know, came down the hallway, and he looked into each cell till he came to my grandfather. And then he said to him, what's your name? So he said, my name is Louis Mozak. He said, no, was ist dein Name? He said in Yiddish. So he said, Avram Eliezer ben Zvi. He said, what are you doing in jail? So he told him why he was in jail. And he said, Poland can't afford to hang their strong, healthy, soldiers. We need you to help fight. And he took out a beating of keys and he unlocked the door and he said to him, he took him to his office, he took out a bunch of paper, he says, I'm going to transfer you to a different battalion. Which place do you want to go to? So he said quickly, and he named the name of a town that was near the border. It didn't border directly with Switzerland, but it was the closest part of Poland to Switzerland. And so he wrote him his transfer papers and he left. And he took the train to that town. But he didn't go to the army. He didn't report for duty. Instead, he deserted a second time. And he went to a shul. He said, Yidden, please help me. I'm trying to escape over the border, and I want to make it to Switzerland. But I don't have any civilian clothing. All I have is my army fatigue. Does anybody have a suit, an outfit of clothing I could wear? So there was one man there. He said, I also have a son in the army. And I have his Shabbos suit. He didn't take his Shabbos suit. So I'll give it to you, and it should be a slip that his son should survive. Now, I don't know what happened to his son, but the man was very nice. He even gave my grandpa a little bit of money, and with the suit and the money, he slipped across the border and eventually made it to Switzerland and then to Chicago, where he had a lot of family. So that was the most popular story of my grandfather and Tehillim. And in our family, we usually recount it at the table on Shmini Atzeres. But a man like him, he didn't just say to him, yes, my mother, Ma, how do you know by heart? I don't know how he knew by heart at age 18, but when I knew him, he used to work, he was a tailor, he had a fashion shop. And it took him about an hour and a half each way to go there and come back somewhere. And what did he do on the hour and a half train, bus ride, whatever? He said to him. He started in the morning, and he finished, he got to work, he was almost done. But I don't think it took him more than 2 hours either. My mother said in 2 hours. I'm sure he did it just as quickly. And I want to just stop for a second and emphasize that it's not how much or how quickly you say it. It's what you put into it. A lot of people can't read that quickly. and orange and experience, and it's fine. That's not what Hashem is looking for. I'm just saying that's the amount of time he spent saying Tehillim. So he spent an hour and a half on the bus saying Tehillim, and then he would finish up the rest of it as he was working. You know, picture your typical or proverbial Polish Jewish tailor sewing while he says Tehillim. That was my grandfather. He was a tailor. Actually, it was much more of a fashion designer, but also a tailor. And on the way home, he started the whole sefer again. And whatever he didn't finish on the way home, he finished at home. So he's actually said sefer to him twice every day for his whole life. And he was a pasha the balabas, that's all. So it was just a not-so-pasha the balabas. My second favorite story about him and my grandfather was really much closer to home. And that's with my mother. Before my mother was born, my grandparents, by the way, my grandfather and grandmother were uncle and niece. They all came from the same, they cut from the same cloth. And when they got married, the first time my grandmother was pregnant, she went to the hospital full term, and the doctor had a dinner, and he told the staff, don't let the baby be born until I come back, because she won't be able to collect the seed. So they literally didn't let the baby be born. Well, aside from being terribly painful, the baby was born sick, and it died. That was baby number one. Baby number two, she doesn't really know what happened. She came to the hospital. They put her to sleep. You have to realize this is like in 1928, 29, 30. They put her to sleep, and when she woke up, they said the baby's sickly, and it died also. So two babies died. And the doctor said to her, lady, there's something wrong with you. You're never going to have normal children. So she was very depressed, but her friend convinced her to go to a different doctor. And he said, no, there's nothing wrong with you. You can have children. And sure enough, she became pregnant again. But this time, she had a miscarriage, you know, midway through. It happened. I think statistically, one out of every five pregnancies is a miscarriage. But after the first two, and now this one, now she was really depressed, and she really didn't think she could have children. So they did two things. The first thing they did was they made a neder and said that Hashem gives them normal, healthy, live children. They will make sure that they will have a total education. Mind you, there was no day school, not for girls, not for boys. There was no base school, there was no Chicago for parochial school, there was no Talmud Torah, nothing. Maybe there was a little Talmud Torah after day school, I don't know, after public school. But all the Jewish kids went to public school. And and they made a measure that if Hashem sent them healthy children, he'd make sure they got a Jewish education. So shortly after that, she became pregnant again, and they were so very worried because this is really the fourth time. So what do you think they did? They davened and set the hill and set the hill. Whatever they were doing before, they doubled and tripled. Until in my grandmother's ninth month, my grandfather had a dream. And this is my favorite part of the story. He had a dream that his grandmother came to him in a dream. And she said to him, stop crying. You're making my tachrichim wet. Apparently, when a child cries in a church and is in pain, the parents feel it. If they're not living, the parents feel it in the grave. She said, stop crying. That's enough. You're making my tachrichim wet. He said, but don't worry, this time everything will be okay. It will be a girl and she'll be healthy. And he said,
speak a little slower, just a little
yes,
slower.
Yes, I'm sorry. Should I go back a step or just continue?
No, go ahead, just continue. I love it. Just
okay. Thank you for telling me. Okay, so okay. She said to him, don't worry, everything will be fine. It'll be a girl and she'll be healthy. She said, one name, give for your mother-in-law. It was actually his sister because he married his sister's daughter. Said, give her a name for your mother, unless she was not living anymore. She had died in the epidemic, of the influenza epidemic, the Spanish one. And he said, the second name said, give for me. And now he's afraid to tell my grandmother that, because what if he jacked it up? Like, they so much wanted to help each other. Imagine it's their fourth pregnancy, and so far, they don't have a baby yet, you know? And the other two of them were full term and died. So they were nervous then, and he didn't know. Did he dream this up because he wanted it should be a healthy baby? He didn't know. So he didn't tell my grandmother anything. But Baruch Hashem, my mother was born. Not that she was alive and healthy, she weighed over 10 pounds.
Right.
And they were so excited. It was like a wintry day, and it was November, and it was snowing in Chicago. And my grandfather was working home because she was born Friday night after Shabbat started. And he didn't know it was snowing. He didn't know anything. He was in seventh heaven. And just so you should know, my grandfather hired a tutor to teach my mother Aleph when she was 3 years old, because there was no school she could go to, and he made a promise, and he wanted to keep it. So these are the parents my mother grew up with, and this is just like my favorite stories of when they said to him. Another time my mother was sick. They didn't know what was wrong with her. It was like 1954, 55. And what she really had was an ectopic pregnancy, but they didn't know. And they didn't know what was wrong with her. They had no sonogram, so they were thinking maybe they should do surgery. In the end, they decided to do exploratory surgery, though it was very, very dangerous. And, of course, my grandmother, the minute my mother didn't feel well, my grandmother came running to New York to take care of her daughter. She already had one child, and she wasn't feeling well. And they didn't know what was wrong with her. But my grandfather didn't come. First of all, he had a business to run. And said, well, what is he going to do in New York? Okay, he couldn't take the home all day. But anyway, so he didn't come. Like I said, he had a business to run. But what he did do, she was scheduled for surgery on Thursday. So what he did was, he went to the basic borough. His father-in-law, his wife's father, he was buried in the cemetery in Chicago. And he said, okay, she's due for surgery. So he's going to go be Miss Powell, say to her on Epic Heather. So he got to the cemetery. It was like 5 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, the cemetery gates were locked. Well, like I said, my grandfather never liked taking no for an answer. So he climbed over the walls of the cemetery, and he was installed at his father-in-law's tether. And Lamaisa, the surgeon, the doctor did the surgery. When they opened her up, like 3 minutes later, her tube burst. You know, an ectopic pregnancy is when the baby forms in the tube, and when the baby gets bigger, there's no room for it. So it puts a lot of stress on the tube, and eventually the tube bursts. And if that happens, mostly the patient dies. But if you catch it before it bursts, so then much better prognosis. So they opened my mother up, and within minutes, the tube burst. And when he came out after the surgery, I mean, obviously my mother lived, I'm here. But he came out after the surgery, and the first words that came out of his mouth when he spoke to my father was, somebody prayed very hard for this lady. He said if the tube had burst 5 minutes earlier, they couldn't have helped her because, you know, whatever consequence would have happened would have been irreversible. But because she was already opened up on the operating table, they were able to, you know, limit the damage. And Baruch Hashem, my mother lived to give, my mother was able to have 6 more children after that, which was also amazing because in those days, people who had ectopic pregnancies and survived usually didn't have any more children. But Baruch Hashem, he was an excellent doctor, and a lot of healing was said. So Baruch Hashem, that's another one of my favorite stories. But the nekuda that really runs through everything is that no matter what happened in their life, they always get to healing. When my mother's mother passed away, I don't remember so much of my grandfather because I was only 6. But when my mother's mother passed away, I was already over 11 years old. And for an entire year after that, and I'm embarrassed to say, no, I do not do this, my mother said a Shabbos afternoon, her Shabbos afternoon activity, well, she said the whole Sefer Tehillim. I mean, of course, what else is she going to do, right? She has a day off, she's going to say Tehillim. And that's because she saw this in her parents' house. My grandmother lived with us when we were little. I mean, not when I was little. My grandfather, I was 6 when he passed away. At 11, my grandmother passed away. And for the 5 years in between, she lived with us. And I remember her all the time. She wasn't a well woman. That's why she didn't live alone. She wasn't a well woman. And she helped a little bit around the house, minor cooking, minor sewing. But mostly she just sat at home all day. My great aunt, you know, my mother-in-law, my grandmother, my grandfather's sister, same thing. When she was elderly, she sat at home all day because that's what they were taught to do. And that's what they lived in their home was you sat at home. Now, I want to go back now to why Tehillim is so powerful. And that's because it's not, like I said before, it's not how many words you say, it's not how many prakim you say, it's not how fast you say it, it's how you say it and what you're feeling when you say it. You know, Hashem is not interested in surface, lip service or superficial service to him. Hashem says, Hashem yer el alevav. Hashem wants to see our heart in it. Now, we have a medrash that tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was a terrific composer. And when he saw that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were saved in such a spectacular fashion from the Kishon HaEish, right? He had them thrown into the fire for whatever. I don't know if they said they don't believe in his idol. I think they just bowed down to his idol, right? I'm sorry, it's a long time since I learned the story, but I believe they wouldn't bow down to the Avodah Zarah. They threw him into the fiery furnace, and everybody saw them walking around like it was nothing. So when he saw this, he composed tremendously with Hashem. And it was beautiful. The words were magnificent. Like, he was a great composer and a great whatever. But and the Malachim and Shemaim, they were very upset because they said, if he sings this Shira, it's going to come to Shemaim, it's going to make David HaMelech Shira look like nothing. It'll make it look like chopped liver. And they were very much protective of David HaMelech Trevor and said, this is terrible, what should we do? So one Malach, I didn't say which one, but he was very clever, he flew down quickly and he patched Nebuchadnezzar on his face. He gave him a big clap. And what did he Nebuchadnezzar did? He started cursing. So when he saw Hashem doing nice miracles, that was wonderful. Oh, he only had nice things to say about Hashem. But give him a patch on punim? Oh my goodness, no way. He started cursing away. And that's the clue that is the difference. Why David HaMelech Tehillim was so beautiful. You know, who said it? The Kutzer Rebbe said, it's not the style of what's written, but when it was written. The many degenerative, immoral writers can boast a fine, polished pen. But that's not what impresses us. We want to know what went into writing this. And if you look into Sefer Tehillim, we find that David HaMelech praised Hashem all the time. Lots of times during the day, but he also praised him during the worst times of his life. You know, what's worse than a child who rebels against the parents? I don't know. I didn't have a rebellious child option. I bet he gave me a few gray hairs. And I have to tell for the silly little gray hairs, the foolish little silly things he did as a 10-year-old, which really weren't anything all that horrible looking back, I can't begin to tell you what heart pain I had from it. And it was nothing. I'm not telling you Lashon Hara. He didn't do anything the typical normal boy doesn't do. They all, you know, it's typical for his age. And Baruch Hashem didn't go any further. So. But I can't imagine the anguish of a parent who has a child to rebel. We call it OTV today, but that's not a new phenomenon. David HaMelech, the great David HaMelech, had a son who rebelled against him. And you know what? It wasn't just the son who rebelled against him. He had a whole army of volunteers. They even had Achitophel. Achitophel was the wisest advisor in the land, the smartest man in the land. Even he, at one point, sided with David HaMelech, people who rose up against him and rebelled against him. And you can't imagine the aggravation. He was chased out of his palace by his own son. And what does he say? A place that David wrote, a song from David, on the occasion of being kicked out of his, on the occasion of him being chased after by his son Absalom. Now, I've read lots of different poems and things that people wrote, but usually it says, a poem, let's say Shlomo Kalbach, or Mordechai ben David. A song composed in honor of his daughter's wedding. That you might hear, but a song that he writes when his son rebelled against him and kicked him out of his house and caused him untold agmat nefesh? I don't know anybody who does that. What's another one he writes? Bamnatzeach. Bamnatzeach means a song for the conductor of the orchestra. This was on the occasion of David HaMelech's son dying. Yeah, the son was Bathsheba. Bathsheba was his wife, one of his wives. And he had a son to her named Yedidiah. And he died. And what did he do when he died? This is a song for the conductor of the orchestra. My son died. I have to sing. My heart wants to sing songs of thanks to Hashem. You know, I've never experienced anything that bad. Baruch Hashem. I've had little ups and downs. And I have to tell you, it's sometimes very hard to say a song of Shira Hashem when life is going tough. But David HaMelech didn't have that problem. He was being chased by Shaul, the king. And he's hiding in a cave, frightened out of his wits. Because in the front of the cave where Shaul HaMelech's men came for the night. And he's a little further back, terrified they're going to find him. What does he do? This is a song for the conductor. I made it a song when I was hiding from Shaul. I feel the thanks to Hashem for doing great things for me. And that's the beauty of David HaMelech Tehillim. Not because his prose is so gorgeous or the words he said are amazing. No, they weren't. It was when they were fine. They were beautiful. I think the words of Tehillim are gorgeous, but that's not the beauty of Sefer Tehillim. The beauty and the music in Tehillim is when they are set. You know, I don't remember who it was. I'm sorry. I apologize. I once heard a story about a boy who was a grandson of a big Hasidic Rebbe. And one day he comes to yeshiva late because he was up till 4 o'clock in the morning learning. So he was a little late coming to learn because he was so tired. And when his grandfather saw that he came so late, his grandfather said, "You missed Minyan," and he gave him a big patch on his face. Now you would think he would, and he didn't say a word. So people said to him, "Why didn't you thank him?" Okay, so you don't get upset with your grandfather. That's a big Milo right there. You didn't start complaining that it's not good. But you could have just said, "Well, Zadie, I was up very late, so I have to sleep a little bit." He didn't say a word. And his friend said to him, "Why didn't you say a word?" He said, "What? I should complain that I should deprive myself of a clock from the Zadie? The Zadie gives me a clock, I should grow and learn from it, and I'm going to give him an excuse why I don't need that clock? We all need clocks to improve ourselves. So fine, I got the clock for a mistake, but who cares? The Zadie gave me a clock, I should grow from the clock." And I just, as I was preparing, I was thinking that's the same idea that David HaMelech had. You know, David HaMelech didn't just thank Hashem for the hardships he gave him. He thanked Hashem for, he asked Hashem to give him hardships. He asked him to give him crops so he could grow. He could grow from the crops. And because he, I'm sorry, this was my turn. Oh, and because he was so happy to accept every single situation in life, though, so his Tehillim is for Doros. He asked Hashem, he said, "Hashem, Kasruni no Doros, could you accept my Tehillim? If somebody learns Tehillim, Adonis and says Tehillim, could you accept it as it says Aharos Unagan? Two of the one of the hardest Mishnayos around. They're very, very complicated. I don't know, very hard, but they're very difficult. And Hashem, he said, "Hashem, please accept it as being the most difficult thing that somebody learns." And the reason why is because Tehillim is David HaMelech invested all of his attitude and all the way he looks at things into his Tehillim. And we know that if a person works on himself to perfect a certain midah, his children inherited. For example, Adam Avinu was an Ish Chesed, and Jewish people are known to be Balei Chesed. They inherit that midah. Rachel Imenu had the midah of Shasika, of being quiet, and her children, Yosef and Mordechai HaTzadik, they're invested, they are imbued with that midah as a Yerusha from her, as their inheritance. So David HaMelech said, "Could you please make my Tehillim a Yerusha to the Jewish people? You know, the people should be able to look and see the necessity for Hashem to give us this Jonah." And that's what Sefer Tehillim is today. It's more valuable than anything else because David HaMelech imbued it with all his straight vision, all his straight thinking, his whole attitude toward what happened when a person suffers. And you know, it's not easy, but I want to end. I see it's about 9:34. I just want to end with a short story that I read not so long ago that really made a big impression on me and would really, well, I'll tell it to you, you'll realize why I'm sharing it with you. So it says there was a young lady who was married, and her husband was very, very difficult to live with, and he left her, and he wouldn't divorce her, and she became an aguna. And really, he ruined her life because she was very young. She could have remarried, but she couldn't because he refused to give her a guest. And she went from one aguna to another for brachos, for aces. You know, they all said different things. But one Adam Gadol, I don't know who, I don't even know if it said so in the story, but he said to her, "Every morning I want you to get up and I want you to look in the mirror and I want you to say, well, not look in the mirror, but I want you to say, 'Thank you, Hashem, for making me an aguna.'" She said, "What?" He said, "Yes. Every morning get up and say, 'Thank you, Hashem, for making me an aguna.'" And she said to him, "How can you say that? It's horrible to be an aguna. It's such a terrible misdemeanor. I'm not thankful for it. I can barely live with it. I'm terribly distraught from it." He said, "Try it. Every day, get up and say, 'Thank you, Hashem, for making me an aguna.'" Well, what does she have to lose? She tried everything else, so she did that. And the first few weeks, it was extremely difficult to get the words even out of her mouth because she still did not believe them. But as she did it every day, and the days turned into weeks, the weeks into a few months, it wasn't so long even, just a few months, when she started saying that, "You know what, there are worse things in life than being an aguna. You know, a person could have cancer and be on a death sentence, you know. There's all kinds of things that could happen to a person. And I did learn a lot of things from being an Aguna. I learned compassion. I learned how to, forgive, I don't know, whatever it was she said she learned. And she kept saying this every day. And eventually, she believed it. You know, she said, I said, yes, you know, thank you, Hashem. I don't know why you made me an Aguna, but I appreciate the standard you gave me, and thank you. And after she came to that realization, she had to say thank you with a Lev Mele. Shortly after that, for some inexplicable reason, her husband turned around and gave her a gift. And I think that's really a big, this is a true story. I'm sorry I don't have better documentation, but it was, I read it somewhere where I felt it was a real story, not just a story somebody made up. I hope so. But even if it's not a real story, but that's really what's supposed to happen. Hashem sent us an Nisayon, and he's supposed to be grateful for it, because it's the most appropriate thing Hashem could do, is whatever he did for us. Because we believe totally that Hashem cares for us, and that whatever happens to us is exactly straight from Hashem. Every ounce of suffering comes from Hashem, and if we don't understand why, that's our chesaron, not his. A parent takes a child to the dentist, and the dentist pulls out a rotten tooth, and the kid doesn't know why and thinks the parent is horrible. And you can never convince him that his parent did a nice thing, but if you would tell him that if we don't pull out the tooth and it becomes abscess, you could die. I have an uncle, by the way, who died from an abscess tooth. He was an older man, and one day his tooth was swollen and hurt, and he decided he'll go to the dentist the next day. But overnight, his mouth blew up, and by morning, he was dead. So if you explain that to your child, oh, yes, thank you so much for causing me all that pain. The problem is that we don't know why Hashem does what he does, but whenever we're experiencing pain, think of a child with an abscess who doesn't understand why you're pulling out his tooth and it hurts. But that's what Hashem does when he causes us pain. He's doing this for our own benefit. And that is the attitude David HaMelech brought to his Tehillim, and that's why it is more valuable than any other tefillah person can do, unless you say your own tefillah from your heart. Now, I wasn't sure, I'm going to end with this, really will end with this. I wasn't sure a few years ago on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, and I saw some of the girls had this new sefer out. And I'm not criticizing the sefer. It's a very nice sefer. Lots of different tefillahs for all kinds of things. And I said to the girl, I said, I don't understand. Why don't you just say Tehillim? So she said, well, because this talks to her more. She understands it more. And I said, yes, but don't you realize Tehillim is worth so much more? It's much more powerful. It's a better weapon. Well, I don't know. I guess she didn't really buy what I was telling her. She enjoyed what she was saying, so fine. She didn't do anything bad, but I asked my husband, is it true? He said, absolutely it's true. You know, it's not the words that we say when we say it to feel. It's not, and this is written in a more language we like better. But when you take the Hillel principle, you can have any kavanos you want. So it's not that it's not talking about what we want to ask Hashem for, because just think about whatever you want, and that's what the Tehillim means. It's the attitude that David HaMelech brought with his Tehillim that makes it so powerful. And aside from that, the second thing which I hadn't thought about is that Tehillim is from the Chazal of Sifrei Tanakh. It's Torah. And the two most powerful weapons we have to change a bad desire in is learning, is Torah, and Tehillah. So Tehillim is both. It's Torah and it's Tehillah. And you want to substitute something not as powerful, you want to take, you know, a Tylenol instead of a what's it called, a heavy duty painkiller? Sure, you could, but just know that you're operating with a much weaker weapon. If you want something that will really, really help you, but it has a bigger chance of working, say Tehillim. It's better than any school under the sun. When my daughter was going out, my husband, a friend of mine who was very nice, she said to me, you know, my daughter just got married. I'll tell you all the school that we did, and it worked, she got married. So I in my chat, I guess I wasn't so nice to her, but I said, you know, I really appreciate it. Very sweet of you, but my husband said to me, don't waste your time with schoolers. Just say Tehillim. It carries much more clout than any school, unless my Kibbutz Aim is not a school. Kibbutz Aim is a mission of the Torah that brings along with it a Rikos Yamin. So unless it's a guarantee that the Torah says to you, the Torah says you should take challah because I think, what is the word? It brings a bracha into your house. That's not a skula. The mitzvah chala is a bracha for a bracha in your house. So that has tremendous value. But unless a person makes up his own tefillah and he cries out those words in his own words from his own heart, then you're much, much better off using the words of David HaMelech. I want to stop here because I went past my allotted time, and I'm sorry if I kept you late. Never feel bad if you have to leave early. Anybody who wants to try to see if it's recorded. If you have any problems, you should always trust me. If you have any feedback, constructive or negative, please, I'm more than happy to hear it. I want this to work for, it should be my school for my mother. It should be a school for my mother. Of course, not a school. Of course, for my mother. So if you have any feedback on how to change it or improve it or whatever, please don't hesitate to call me. My number is 773-983-9703. Sure, you can find my number if that was too fast. A lot of people have it. And if you got this information on a WhatsApp, you can always WhatsApp me. Thank you so, so much for coming.